TUE Drive with Paul Murray, thanks for listening. Now, there are two people that made me want to get involved in radio. One was Stan Zemanek, the other is Tony Martin. I had the pleasure of meeting Stan a couple of years ago, and I now have the exact pleasure of talking to Tony Martin. Tony, good afternoon.
Hello, Paul. Yes, we're often confused, Stan. I think he might have done Shoot the Celebrity in the Arse. That was one of my most popular segments in the 90s. Sorry, can I say arse on this station? I probably shouldn't.
It's fine. I got in trouble for saying bloody the other day, and there was a formal warning at crap, but that's okay.
I remember when bloody, you couldn't say bloody at all in the streets.
Oh, yes, and they shot you.
It was shocking.
Yeah. Now, what the reason for talking to you today, apart from the fanboy gets a chance to have a chat, is the ABC, you've got a show called A Quiet Word, where you sit down and you have some conversations with people that it's quite obvious that you're interested in. This week it's going to be Rob Sitch. These are genuinely fascinating and funny people from movies, music and all the rest. Is it nice to sit down and just have a chat, no ads? No mucking around?
It certainly is, and not having to throw to, you know, Supertramp, that's quite nice. But, yeah, it's great because you've done radio for a while, and you know what it's like. You have people on every day, and there's some people who you're huge fans of. Then there's some people that you're not such big fans of, but you pretend.
Yes.
And then there's people you've never heard of, but you looked up on Wikipedia the night before, and you act as if you know all about them. Well, I thought, well, be great on TV to just do the first category, just people that I am genuinely a fan of, so I don't have to fake it or pretend.
And how do you dance when you're sitting opposite, say, someone like Lily Tomlin, who clearly you liked and you knew an awful lot, at times almost more than her, about her career? What's it like? How do you sort of hold back on the, I just love you, let's just talk and be really nerdy together for a while?
Well, it's amazing when these people come out here and they get whisked onto TV shows where they can only be on for a couple of minutes, and radio shows and things where, you know, they'll be told, oh, don't mention that because no one will have heard of that. And, you know, I think Lily Tomlin, every single interview, it was, are you gay and what's the story with that clip on YouTube? And so I think it was quite a not all of them, actually, because The Circle actually had her on for a whole 2 hours. It was fantastic.
Wow.
But you know, I think it's quite a novelty for her to just be asked about her characters in movies.
Yeah, and my thing too is that often interviews end up going for 3 minutes on the radio, and clearly fascinating and interesting people who fit into that first category. You don't talk to them for an hour because you're desperately trying to stalk them. There's probably an hour's worth of stuff to talk to them about.
Well, the great thing is when you go, because our show is 26 minutes, and you can go off on a ridiculous tangent in a way that you can't if it's like 10 minutes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Say, I always use this example, Bill Bailey. If you had Bill Bailey on for 10 minutes, you couldn't waste 3 minutes of it talking about whether the bloke who replaced Dave in Chaz and Dave was called Dave, and if he wasn't, how awkward that must have been for him. And that's what we did. And so, you know, you can spend, in 26 minutes, you can sort of afford to go off on irrelevant tangents for a little while and then come back to the side of the pool.
Now, being AM radio, I just need to do this. Sorry, you know, I lose my job if I don't play those.
I love those. We'll be right back after these noises.
That's the thing, because I mean, in all of the radio that you've done, and most recently at Triple M, we'd get this. There was a lot of that stuff about AM radio. As somebody, we'll get into your love of movies soon, but as somebody who clearly has loved radio, what do you find particularly funny about what we do?
Well, I just remember there was always a lot of controversy when we would do a segment on sorry to mention Triple M, but I need to explain, we would change the name of it to Triple AM for 10 minutes, and we would thin out the sound and just have constant meow, 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 meow noises that would come in. I used to, because I started out in the 80s, in AM radio, and they were constantly going, you've got to get those sound breakers in. They just constantly come out of nowhere, these weird synthesized noises.
My favourite is when you turn around and I don't know, you say something mildly amusing and it's immediately followed by...
They're fantastic, those. I used to have an album that just had hundreds of those all on both sides. Just play it in the office and drive people crazy. The old two Ronnie. You know that one?
Yes. Well, my favourite too is because they're often used to symbolise what has just gone before, and often somebody will try and say something incredibly profound and then immediately follows.
I think I've told this story a few times, but we worked with a radio announcer who was in the Vietnam War, and he wanted to do on Anzac Day a very special tribute to his fallen comrades, as you would. Mm. And he practiced his speech, and he was going to go into Only 19. But to check how the song started, he just played it in queue, you know, on a cart.
Yes.
Cart?
Yes.
It's hard to explain to people what that is. It's like a cassette. So once you've played it, you've got to wait till it goes all the way around to the beginning again. And so he started his speech and then realised that the song wasn't going to cue in time. So just went to whatever was the next song. And he goes, "So guys, this one's for you." And went into Mental as Anything too many times. Which is like the wackiest, most fairground nuts beginning you've ever heard. And it was terrible, but it was at the same time hilarious.
Oh, now look, obviously I worked in Sydney when you worked in Melbourne and across the country at Triple M, so there's one or two myths about you in radio that I need to ask about, is that, and as a huge fan, I know that the sketches and the rest, you slaved over those all the time, but is it true that before you had conversations with people on the air, that you would furiously rehearse what you were going to say, or is that just one of those great made-up things?
The opposite. We would often, with Martin Malloy, we would rehearse what often seemed to be quite natural conversations about something in the news would have been written for several hours that day, and then we would try and make it sound, because it's not a good sound, people working hard on the radio.
I agree.
So we would try, and it was an acting exercise. We would think of something funny and it'd be, "You say that, you say that," and we would turn it into a casual conversation. Whereas when we had guests on, we would do the opposite. We would say, "Don't tell us anything till we're on air." And I've talked about this with you. It's something I think Howard Stern likes to do. Whereas, you know, someone will come in, and often what happens with a radio interview is they'll tell you the story off air, and then when they do it on air, you've already heard it, and so the laughter is kind of fake. And
yes.
So we were big on that.
Well, also, this is an interesting thing. Another one, apparently, who does that is Letterman, because Johnny Carson used to do it, which was that he never meets the people that, no matter how famous they are, until they are physically on the show.
That's right, and that used to sound crazy. It made him sound like a nut. And then when you actually do it yourself, you realise what a smart thing that is.
Yeah. Of all of those people that you had the chance to talk to, I remember, I think it was Martin Malloy, but when you spoke to Adam West, the 60s Batman, and devastating lookalike of Tony Abbott, I think, is that this, you could tell that there was a great fun in you guys being able to talk to him. But was there anyone obscure or important who genuinely surprised you about how amazingly interesting and funny they actually were? Because Adam West was awesome.
Oh, Adam, we tracked him down. I think he's a lovely man, but because he wasn't promoting anything, I remember we had to send a check for $250 and he wouldn't speak to us until the check had cleared.
Oh,
so we had to wait like 10 days. And then I think we spoke to him. He was in a Jeep dealership buying a car while we were actually interviewing him on air. But he was fantastic. I love Adam West. I think he's one of the great underrated comedy actors of our time. There's a show on YouTube called Look Well, which is a pilot for a TV series he did that never got up, where he plays an actor who used to be a TV detective who now spends his days interfering in actual crime cases. And it's one of the great bits of comedy acting. But I remember one guest who was really interesting was, remember that movie Donnie Brasco?
Oh, yes.
Well, remember it was about a guy, Johnny Depp played a guy who informed on the mob and had, like, you know, 20, and had to be in witness protection. Well, Johnny Depp wasn't able to come out and promote that film, so they got the real guy.
That's right, yeah.
Joey Pistone.
Yes.
And he came out, and he, you know, this guy had $20 million worth of contracts out on his life, and he's going around to radio stations and playing secret sound. And he came in, and he had a hat on. All he had was a baseball cap with a wig under it that made his hair look different. and he had a bodyguard with him, just one guy, who was like Kato in the Inspector Clouseau movies. Like, when we came out of the studio, this guy just leapt out of the door and just went, ha-ha, and struck a pose. So that this guy, Pistone, would be, you know, constantly on alert. It's very odd.
But it's ridiculous that when you're trying to hide from the mob, you're out there saying, hey, look at me.
Yeah, don't, I'll come to my film premiere.
Yeah, I'll go to an OB where you can get a clean shot.
Great. I remember that's one of the few autographs I got. I thought, well, this would be a good one to get.
Yeah. But when you turn around, and also, I mean, you did it with two radio shows and the TV show with The Late Show and so many things. You end up sort of being in the middle of something people get incredibly passionate about. And what's that like when you're in the middle of something that takes so much work, but you know so many people are into it, that when the show wound up on Triple M, people actually literally protested in the streets. Are you aware of that massive support, or because it's honestly so much hard work making the thing they love, you don't actually get to go out to restaurants and eat for free?
Oh, no, well, I'm very rarely recognised in the street, or if I am, people think it's either Andrew Denton, James Valentine, or the little cartoon man from the Computers for Dummies book. But we would get, especially since email, when we were doing Get This, I mean, we would get so many emails and people would let you know. And when the show was axed, we were printing out the emails. I remember I stopped counting them at 30,000.
Wow.
So I've still got them all in storage somewhere. But people were so into that show that it's what keeps you going, because you're up all night. You know, I would stay up all night just listening to a Barry White song, trying to think of a sketch where it could be on in the back. You know, it's insane amount of detail for something. You go, no one's going to get this. And then, you know, you get 100 emails about it, and that's sort of what keeps you going. And I remember the podcast for Get This, which, I mean, that show's been off for 3 years. It was only on for 2 years, been off for three, and yet the podcasts are still regularly in the top 100 comedy podcasts at iTunes. And me and Matty D on the Pots and Pans, we would spend 2 hours a day editing those podcasts. And I remember thinking, even for us, we're going, this is, what are we doing this much work for? But when people are still listening to them 3 years on, you go, thank God we went to so much trouble.
Well, see, it's funny you talk about all of that extreme work. I just got the Larry Sanders Show on DVD, the full box set, and it has...
Masterpiece, isn't it?
Oh, it's beyond awesome. It's they say, you know, it's what made HBO famous. I say it's what made TV relevant for the next 20 years.
Yeah,
is
great.
That it turns around, and there's a special disc of features on all of that, which is a two-hour behind-the-scenes with Gary Shandling.
Oh,
who,
that's great, that one.
Oh, it's tremendous. But the thing that totally came through to me is that when he threw his entire life into that show, that basically he went nuts after it. And as incredible as the work is, the pressure of it, clearly he's just gone off and said, that's it, I'm not doing anything for the next 10 years, it's too much work. When you throw as much of yourself into it, how have you been able to get up and go again and not just gone nuts?
Oh, well, you do go. I did go a bit nuts. And that's, I wrote a book for a year and a half after we did Get This, because it's, I mean, I call them shows like that, Martin Malloy, they're like, I call them going to war shows, because you're basically giving over your entire life to them. You know, there's no work hours. You're just always on duty. You're always looking. I remember on Get This, every single moment of my day was filled with work. Like, when I was eating dinner, I would always have a fork in one hand and a remote in the other, because that was when I had to go through the Channel 10 news to see if Mal Walden had used any funny words that day. It was like, and I'd wake up in the morning and my eyes would open and I'd immediately go, what's the sketch today? You know, even before I got out of bed. Yeah. And you're giving over your whole, and as you can probably guess, I don't have children, so I'm able to do this. You just give over your whole life to the show. And I think people can tell when you're into it that much. They like that, some, but not everyone, but the people who like it really like it.
And do people understand when you can't go to, you know, your brother's best mate's birthday party, all those things you get invited to because either they like you personally or they like the idea of knowing you?
Yeah, sorry, I've got to listen to 15 Barry White songs. I can't come. It's for a sketch.
Yeah, sorry, one second. Now, let's talk about the show and A Quiet World, which, of course, is on this Saturday night. The person you're sitting down with is Rob Sitch, the bloke that you work with so beautifully on The Late Show. That show, for a lot of people, in the same way the radio shows too, was just incredible. You created something that before, really, too many people taped things in anything but a boring, hard-to-do G-code VHS way, is that you actually got people to stay and watch telly on Saturday night on the ABC, who normally would have been out, I don't know, skylarking all the stuff we whinge about here on AM radio. What was it like those years when you were making that show?
Well, that was mad because I think, I still to this day don't think that there's ever been another show where the people who were in it and wrote it also filmed, edited, sound mixed, post-produced, financed, and, you know, did so much of the actual, you know, legwork themselves. I mean, there's a DVD out of the Best of the Late Show. It goes 5.25 hours. 2 hours of those were just made by us on home video. Obviously, we didn't make the whole show, but all that, the street interviews and the shit scared segments and some of the long filmed pieces, we would make them ourselves. So it was like a film school. Like, we weren't just writing and being in it. We were, you know, you have to learn about framing and sound mixing and stuff like that.
So. And is it one of those strange things too, that when you're making a show like that, and clearly the whole team works so beautifully together, but how hard is it when you're the only person in the room who thinks your idea is funny, and is it hard battling through those things, or did it work that, okay, Tony, you've got X percent of the show, Mick, you've got Y percent, all of that?
I always say nothing was ever rejected from The Late Show, because you get to Thursday and you'd be looking at the whiteboard and you're going, I think we're still 23 minutes short. Whereas I worked on a show a couple of years ago with Sean McAuliffe and his writers Gary McCaffrey and Michael Ward, and they work in a completely different way. They write a huge amount of material and then you have to read it out to the group and people vote on whether it's good enough, and that was quite scary. But The Late Show, I think one of the secrets of that show was that we always thought of it as year 6 and 7 of our radio show, because we did breakfast on Melbourne Triple M, what was actually called Eon FM in the 80s, in the Wawani era. And so we did that for 5 years, and then that team went over to do the TV show, and we sort of just continued what we were doing on radio in a way.
Now, my favourite of all of the sketches was the Warren Perso sketch, which just, like, we'll play a bit of it in a second, but I just love everything about that sketch, because, again, it's what obviously you'd always done, but certainly once radio kicked in again, it was evident too that you just love movies, and also the nonsense of the fish out of water idea of the idiots making them.
One we made completely ourselves. $10,000 that sketch cost. I remember writing a check for $1,500 just for the two posters that are up on the wall behind Warren Perso.
Wow!
But that was just, you know, that was, I think that might have been the first proper thing I actually directed as well. So that was another sort of film school exercise. But that was based on, I had lunch with I won't name him because it's rude. People always think it's Anthony Ganane, who I'd actually never heard of when I wrote that sketch, because I look a bit like him. But it was a famous Australian film director who, everything he said was hilarious. Like, you know when you're at lunch with someone and you're writing down what they're saying underneath the... And he was talking to me, literally whole swathes of dialogue from that sketch were word for word. He was going, Tony, the problem with Australian films these days is they're all about bloody losers, people like Burke and Wills and Gallipoli. In my day, films are about winners. Blokes like Alvin Purple. I couldn't write it down fast enough.
That's tremendous. And when you turn around, and after actually making movies yourself, when you start going around the current film industry, do you find that those people don't really exist anymore, and it's all very worthy people who want to make movies about drug addicts and bad dads?
Heroin addicts in love is a cert for funding, I find. But I think there is a bit of truth to that, because a lot of those guys came up in the 10BA era, which was madness, if you remember. Wasn't there like something like 150% rebate?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
So, but at the same time, it meant that a huge amount of people got to make movies and got trained, and, you know, that it was like a great big mad film school, and a lot of really bad films were made, but people learnt how to do their job on those bad movies.
So. Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, that's true. But I just love those. I just wish that we had a few more of those moustached madmen running around.
Yeah. Well, I think Tony Ganane actually became head of the producers Guild, I might be wrong about this, a couple of years ago, and I thought, wow, we'll see more films like Turkey Shoot being made again.
Now, we've got Logie's coming up on Sunday, and that is a lot of the cool kids roll their eyes and go, ugh, who cares? But the reality is that we actually are making some kind of okay TV at the moment. Is there stuff that you particularly like that I can give the Tony Martin seal of approval, put a sticker on the DVD?
You mean Australian things?
Yeah.
Look, I tend to like things that a lot of other people don't like, so I'm bad for recommendations. There was an Australian comedy show a couple of years ago called Very Small Business. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do, yes.
I only went for one series, and with Wayne Hope and Kim Gingell. It had quite a claustrophobic opening episode where I think it was just the two characters in a room, and so a lot of people didn't make it past ep one, but I thought the people who stuck with that show really liked it. I thought that was a really underrated Australian show, but yeah, there's always good stuff on.
So my thing is that when you turn around and you see something like, you know, I'm on Sunday night, you know, Packed to the Rafters wins 400 of them, or the best comedy is the broadest possible one around, do you invariably use your brain to see the best that something has to offer, or because you know how it's made, if it's a bit crap, you just throw it aside and you won't watch it?
I mean, it's great that Australian drama is popular, but I mean, is it rude to say that we don't have anything as good as, say, Breaking Bad or The Sopranos on? And I know what the answer to that is. They've got a lot more money and a lot more development money and a lot more time and a lot more of everything. But, you know, there's just so many, you know, there's so many great shows. In terms of drama, I tend to watch, disgracefully, a lot of overseas shows. I tell you, the one I just think was the best ever, though, is Blue Murder.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I just find myself measuring everything against Blue Murder when it comes on.
Yeah, I think Richard Roxburgh should well and truly be a massive star. He should be as big as Hugh Jackman. I think he is awesome.
Yeah, that Roger Rogers, and that was one of the great performances.
But that's the thing, what I find frustrating a lot when I watch Australian TV is that regardless of what the circumstance is, it could be behind the scenes, I don't know, when Ben Chifley was Prime Minister, or it'll be a scene in Farmer Wants a Wife, or it'll be anything in between. The only way that Australians can convey drama is to say, if we don't bloody do this, then it'll be the bloody death of us. Like, that's the only way we can communicate, and it's not the way real people talk.
No, and I think it's a bit, I mean, I'm probably being very unfair in comparing them with those HBO shows, but I'm assuming it's because they have a lot more writers. It's like the old comedy thing. You know, in England, two writers will do a series of six episodes, and in America, 20 writers will do a series of 24 episodes, but in Australia, we sort of want two guys to write 12.
Yeah, and I think it's also the thing that when you say take a look at something like The Daily Show, which everyone says, why isn't there an Australian version of The Daily Show? And I think the show that you guys did on SBS with Sean McAuliffe was absolutely as close as we'll ever get. The reality is only 1 million people in America actually watch The Daily Show. Only 1 million people watch Californication, which is 1/300th of the population, which would probably be the test pattern on SBS for Australia.
That's right. It's just the main problem we have for television is there's just not enough people, because, you know, you mentioned the Larry Sanders Show. I remember when that was on in the 90s, a friend of mine went to America and he said he could not find a single person who even heard of it.
Wow.
And yet that's a show that was probably watched by, 3 million people, 4 million. Well, luckily, you know, 3 million here would be the most popular show of all time.
Yeah, exactly. Which still is currently a cooking show. That's just very strange.
Yeah, I know. Well, look, I'm just one of these annoying nerds that, you know, if I see someone watching MasterChef, I go, you know, that's good, but watch, have a look at this, and I'll sling them Father Ted. Or the Royal Family. Do you remember that show?
Yes, or you make them sit there and watch the entire season one of The Wire.
Oh, man. People are turning on The Wire, aren't they? It's like being told to eat your broccoli to watch The Wire now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I just got through all of The Shield, which is, if The Wire is too complicated for you, The Shield has less characters but is absolutely riveting.
Yeah, and Michael Chiklis, which I just still think is one of the great unintentional comedy names of Hollywood.
That's right. He was the commish.
Yeah, the commish. All right, well, you could see on Saturday night, you could see Tony Martin on the ABC. It's called A Quiet Word. A few more reps to come.
Yes, we've Rob Sitch is this week, and then we've got Rob Brydon, Catherine Tate, Ross Noble, Shul McAuliffe, and Richard E. Grant.
Oh, that's all going to be very awesome on a Saturday night. All right, you've got everyone booked. Tony, what a thrill to talk to you, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul, and great bunch of topics you brought up there.
Oh, hang on, one more time.
Yes, and we'll have those damn levels for you in just a moment.